KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, February 15th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, a FEMA official dropped by the studio with a message for people affected by the Marshall Fire and high wind event. We'll have a new story in our fossil fuel transition series from the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Coalition. After that comes the latest edition of H2O Radio's This Week in Water. And then we'll go to our listener comment line. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have the BBC News headlines. How on Earth is taking a break this week? Instead, we'll air the latest Rising Tide podcast, featuring an interview with a forensic scientist about how chemicals in sunscreens are affecting the health of coral reefs. At 9 a.m., it's the wit and wisdom of Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker, known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, Terry Reardon will be in the Boulder studio to bring you 2.5 hours of eclectic music with the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first, it's time for the headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
Mesa County Clerk and Recorder Tina Peters announced yesterday she's running for Colorado Secretary of State. Peters, who's under investigation for official misconduct and security breaches to her county's election system, made the announcement during the podcast hosted by Steve Bannon, former strategist to President Donald Trump. According to Colorado Newsline, Peters has not yet filed to run for the position and still has an active campaign to run for another term as clerk and recorder in Mesa County. Peters, along with the former president and his proponents, has consistently echoed conspiracy theories about the 2020 election being stolen. Authorities arrested Peters last week for obstructing officers as they attempted to execute a search warrant for an iPad she allegedly used while recording a hearing that was against a judge's order. After the arrest, Peters appeared in Castle Rock at a gathering of far-right activists in which a speaker called for the hanging of Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold. The Boulder County Board of Health has agreed to end its indoor mask order starting this Friday. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
Boulder County Board of Health last night unanimously agreed to lift its mask order for indoor public settings, including school and child care settings. The Daily Camera reports that about 700 signed up online to last night's board meeting, with 30 people making comments during the public statement period. Many residents spoke out against forcing young children to wear masks, saying the mandate has been detrimental to children's mental health and ability to learn. Board President Greg Thomas said that they placed the mandate last September because of the rise of cases from the Delta variant and continued the mandate with the rise of the Omicron variant. He said that a mask mandate may be reinstated if COVID-19 cases surge again. COVID-19 cases in the county are falling, but are still above 2021 levels, keeping Boulder County's transmission rate high. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
In other COVID news, the Colorado Health Department announced new guidance for schools on Friday. Beginning February 28th, students exposed to the coronavirus at school will no longer have to quarantine, and districts can scale back contact tracing unless there's an outbreak. As new Omicron infections subside, Colorado marked a new grim milestone yesterday by officially surpassing 12,000 deaths from COVID-19. According to the Denver Gazette, roughly a third of the 12,000-plus deaths were confirmed since October, with the unvaccinated making up a disproportionate number of those deaths. The Cherry Creek School District moved its Board of Education meeting to a virtual broadcast last evening due to a perceived bomb threat by an individual with a documented criminal history. A district spokesperson told the Aurora Sentinel the threat did not reference a single issue or policy. The Aurora Sentinel reports a similar scenario occurred last week for Jefferson County Public Schools. During a board study session, a person who wanted masking in schools to end made a threatening phone call to the superintendent's office. The concerning threat prompted school officials to secure the building where the board session was occurring. According to the Aurora Sentinel, Cherry Creek School District board meetings have grown more contentious since the summer as attendees have argued about pandemic health measures and critical race theory. The United States Senate passed legislation yesterday making the former Amachi Japanese internment camp located outside the town of Granada in southeastern Colorado a National Historic Site. The incarceration camp, one of several across the United States, held nearly 8,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. The United States House of Representatives passed the Amachi legislation last year, which was co-sponsored by Colorado Representatives Joe Neguse and Ken Buck. The Senate's passage of the bill comes just before the 80th anniversary of when President Franklin Roosevelt signed an executive order on February 19, 1942, forcibly placing 120,000 Japanese Americans to prison camps. Denver City Council unanimously approved a near $1.4 million contract with Mental Health Center of Denver to expand the Support Team Assisted Response, or STAR, program. Under the program, teams of emergency medical technicians and behavioral health clinicians, instead of police, respond to low-level, nonviolent situations. The program began in June 2020 and has responded to people experiencing crisis such as mental health episodes, homelessness, and substance abuse. Last night's approval by the City Council funds the program through the end of this year. Under the program's expansion, Mental Health Center of Denver has hired new clinicians and EMTs and will now respond to calls 7 days a week, 16 hours a day, throughout Denver. Officials estimate the program will respond to 10,000 calls annually. The new contract also requires a 15-member community advisory committee to provide oversight and tracking of the program. Today's weather includes partly sunny skies with highs in the upper 50s. Tonight, skies will be mostly cloudy with lows in the 20s. Patches of fog are expected after 3 a.m. Tomorrow, snow is likely with moisture starting after 11 a.m. The current temperature outside the Boulder studios is 36 degrees. For KJNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KJNU. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, continues its work in Boulder County in response to the December 30th Marshall Fire and windstorm. President Joe Biden's disaster declaration has been expanded to include funding for repairs and replacement of damaged public infrastructure. FEMA is encouraging all affected persons to make contact in order to apply for disaster assistance before the upcoming deadline. As part of an effort to get the word out, FEMA Public Affairs Specialist Anthony Main dropped by the Boulder studio for a quick conversation.
I'm just coming by to visit and just to say hi, but also to share some information for the people who may have been affected by the Marshall Fire, high winds, and smoke damage. We just want to let them know March 2nd is the last day that they can apply for FEMA assistance. And here's the good part. They can come see us. We're still in Lafayette. We're at 1755 South Public Road. They can come see us in person at the Disaster Recovery Center. If they don't want to come there, they can call us. We can give you the 800 number. Or they can go online to disasterassistance.gov. And we even have a mobile app they can use too.
What types of assistance can people access by going to that center?
When you come apply for FEMA assistance, it unlocks everything. Because we have our partners there from the SBA, they can help you also. But the first step is come to FEMA, apply for assistance, and then from there, the doors are open, as they say.
And what are you seeing are the largest needs of the people who have already come to the center?
There's a lot of people. A lot of people lost their homes, but a lot of people who haven't come see us, they have smoke damage. Their house may have not have been damaged or partially damaged, but they may have smoke. They may have thrown out their food or other stuff because of power, the water, stuff like that. They may not think that they're eligible. Come, see what you can apply for.
And for example, in the case of smoke damage, as you mentioned, many people, including people at this radio station, have had to go live in hotels for a time, even if their house survived the fire. But the smoke damage it permeated everything inside of their homes, and they were unable to live inside of their own structures, even if they were undamaged. Would they be able to unlock funds, for example, to recover some of the costs of staying in hotels?
It's all possibility. First step, come to the DRC, contact FEMA, apply for disaster assistance through FEMA. But you only have until March 2nd.
This particular area of Colorado is going through a housing crisis. There is just not enough housing stock to meet the demand of people who live here. Is there any plans to bring FEMA trailers into the area for people to remain in this region without having to leave?
My current understanding is no, but, you know, I'm not privy to everything, but there's something that still, you know, what the county, what the state have requested, you know, we have worked and done our best in partnership with them to provide that for this community that has been so affected terribly by this fire, high winds, and smoke.
Tell us about the mitigation efforts.
Yes, we have. Did you know we have mitigation specialists that are going out to the big box stores, Lowe's, Home Depot, and Ace, to talk with people, to give them tips about rebuilding, fire mitigation, and things like that. And they'll be there throughout the rest of the month. And hey, if you need help, come out, talk to them. If you're going to, because everyone who's been affected is going to be rebuilding their house, so they can talk to our experts who are, you know, this is what they do, mitigation. So just to help them out.
Okay. Anything else that you would like to add?
Hey, I'm still going to say, hey, if you've been affected by the Marshall winds, high winds, fire, smoke, come see us. Come contact us at 1-800-621-3362. Go to disasterassistance.gov or come see us at the Disaster Recovery Center in Lafayette at 1755 South Public Road.
That was FEMA spokesperson Anthony Main. You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. We'll be right back. We now turn to our ongoing collaboration with Rocky Mountain Community Radio, examining the transition away from fossil fuels in the Mountain West. As the U.S. transitions away from coal, many communities are looking to tourism to fill the economic gap left behind by a shuttered industry. Many other communities began that transition decades ago and now are facing new challenges. As KBUT's Christopher Biddle reports, there's a new initiative in the Colorado legislature to rewrite some of the rules of the post-coal economy.
Gunnison County Commissioner Jonathan Houck assumed his leadership role just as the coal industry there was really bottoming out. The closure of two mines, one suddenly after a fire and subsequent collapse, was a big hit to the county's tax base. Here's how Houck puts it in perspective.
If you equate what that meant to the economy here and what that would look like to Denver, that would be like a company with 17,000 people leaving Denver. That's a big deal.
But luckily, Gunnison County had planned for this. Over the other side of Kebler Pass is the town of Crested Butte, once an outpost for the numerous mines of all sorts in the area. In the 60s, when the industry couldn't sustain the town anymore, the locals successfully made the switch to skiing. In time, Crested Butte also became a hub for mountain biking and became famous for its wildflower festival held every spring. In 2002, the county took advantage of a state law that allowed it to collect a 4% lodging tax. Again, Jonathan Houck.
So that could be a hotel, a motel, a bed and breakfast, a short-term rental, anything under 30 days, they pay that fee, that tax. And that then goes into a fund that is overseen by the Board of County Commissioners.
Who are then obligated to spend that money on tourism promotion. And it worked. Save for the Great Recession, the area saw steady growth in visitation for almost two decades. But tourism also began to take its toll on the community. Waves of gentrification doubled and then tripled the cost of housing. The urban hordes trashed natural settings and eroded bike trails. Locals complained about a lack of diverse job offerings. The community adapted to some of these concerns. Local organizers and volunteer groups took stewardship of the trails and other natural settings. The ICE Lab, a sort of training school for entrepreneurs, came right out of federal money meant for communities transitioning from coal and was meant to bring new and exciting jobs. Still, the housing problem just got worse and worse. All the while, a growing contingent of residents were calling for a halt to marketing for tourism while the county dealt with more pressing problems. Then the pandemic hit. The system collapsed and never fully recovered. The town of Crested Butte declared an official housing emergency. Worker shortages closed businesses, and the cost of housing shot up again. In a knee-jerk reaction, county commissioners turned off summer tourism marketing and used the money instead to promote the local college, because at least students could live in dorms and wouldn't be adding to the problem. 2 years out, with the housing crisis in full swing, Hauk wants to spend money on something that helps, not just something that doesn't hurt. Which is why he's asking the legislature to change the rules for lodging taxes.
Trust communities. They're still going to market. They still want to bring people to their community. But at the same time, they want to grow the amenities that they need for the workers and for the landscape. And so that's really what we're trying to do, is not pigeonhole it into it can only be for housing, but housing could be one of many things that this expanded use would allow.
State Representative Dylan Roberts, a Democrat of Avon, agrees.
And of course, our mountain communities are great, and people are certainly coming to visit our mountain communities. And so there's been a push by county commissioners and local governments to ask us to change the law so that they can use lodging tax revenue for workforce needs like housing, childcare, community development.
That's Representative Roberts speaking at a town hall event in early January before he and a bipartisan group of lawmakers introduced a bill that would open the door for lodging taxes to go somewhere other than tourism marketing.
And so that would be a really exciting, sustainable source of funding for affordable housing for our workforce or other workforce needs.
Roberts has bipartisan support with Republican sponsors in both the Senate and the House. The bill was orchestrated mostly by a coalition of Colorado counties, and Hauk played a major role in its writing. It's not the first time he's tried to push an idea like this, and he usually meets a united front from tourist industry leaders like Vail and Alterra. He thinks that this year, the situation has changed for enough communities that the bill will pass. There is still one operating coal mine in Gunnison County, and coal still makes up a major part of the county's tax revenue. The mine's eventual closure may not be as big of a hit to the county next time around if they have new options. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Christopher Biddle.
Time now for the latest edition of This Week in Water from H2O Radio.
Generating power while saving water. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The first ever meeting of world leaders to address the crisis facing the oceans took place in France last week. The One Ocean Summit discussed illegal fishing, plastic pollution, and carbon emissions from the shipping industry. And there was progress in some areas.
To preserve biodiversity, a coalition led by the European Union will pursue an agreement extending protections to the high seas, which constitute 95% of the ocean.
The U.S. said it would support talks toward an agreement on plastic pollution. About 8 million metric tons of plastic waste enters the world's ocean each year, the equivalent of dumping a garbage truck of plastic waste into the ocean every minute.
European shipping companies said they would establish new targets to cut carbon emissions and underwater noise. And 14 nations committed to strengthen efforts to combat illegal fishing, including better policing in ports and at sea.
John Kerry, the U.S. Special Envoy for Climate, said that some fishing operations are indistinguishable from major criminal enterprises using appalling labor practices, laundering money, and destroying the good efforts of fishers who try to live by the rules.
The conference started just days after an environmental group, Sea Shepherd, released horrifying images of 100,000 dead fish floating off the southwest coast of France. The organization suspects the fish were bycatch, those not wanted or unable to be sold, and were caught by a trawler dragging a net. Kerry said the practice is depleting fish stocks by throwing away two-thirds of what is caught.
About one in every three people in the U.S. has been found to have detectable levels of a toxic herbicide in their bodies that has been linked to birth defects, reproductive problems, and leukemia in children, among other health issues.
A new study from George Washington University shows that the chemical called 2,4-D has seen a resurgence among farmers since weeds have become resistant to glyphosate, the compound commonly found in Roundup.
Among all those tested, children aged 6 to 11 and women of childbearing age showed substantially higher levels of 2,4-D in their urine compared to other groups.
The National Pesticide Information Center says there are more than 1,000 products with 2,4-D that are sold in the U.S., including Weed Be Gone made by Ortho.
The researchers explain that children can be exposed to the chemical by being barefoot on lawns treated with the weed killer, or if they put their hands in their mouths after playing outside.
Also, people are exposed to 2,4-D through eating foods and drinking water containing its residue. However, the EPA says products containing the chemicals are safe if label directions are followed.
Last year, a study by the University of California showed that if the state covered all its 4,000 miles of canals with solar panels, they could generate substantial amounts of energy and save billions of gallons of water from being lost to evaporation.
That research is now being put to the test. The state has awarded $20 million to the Turlock Irrigation District in California's Central Valley to test using solar panels on its canals, the first such experiment in the country.
Called Project Nexus, for its combined water and energy benefits, the development is expected not only to decrease evaporation and generate renewable energy, but also improve water quality and lower maintenance by reducing the growth of aquatic weeds.
The water will keep the panels cool, enhancing their efficiency. Also, by using canals for renewable energy, it avoids converting large tracts of land into solar farms to meet the state's goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 2030.
Project Nexus will break ground this fall and take 2 years to complete. If successful, it could be replicated on other canals.
And finally, dinosaurs. They were just like us. They got sick and were miserable. That was probably the case with Dolly, a long-necked sauropod who lived in present-day Montana, which 150 million years ago was a warm, humid coastal river system.
Carrie Woodruff, a paleontologist at the Great Plains Dinosaur Museum in Malta, Montana, was recently examining Dolly's fossils when he noticed some unusual broccoli-like protrusions in several of her neck bones.
But he wasn't sure what to make of them. So he posted photos to social media, and researchers quickly replied that the lesions were similar to growths found in modern-day birds and reptiles when they had respiratory infections.
Just like birds today, sauropods had a series of air sacs near and in their bones that connected to their lungs. Woodruff and his team concluded that Dolly probably got air sacculitis, which is common today in birds, but never known to occur in dinosaurs.
He said Dolly would have looked sick, coughing, sneezing, headache, fever, and with bouts of diarrhea.
Birds that get air sacculitis today are treated with antibiotics, but Dolly was the length of a tractor trailer, so if a pill had been available back in the late Jurassic, would it have needed to be the size of a toaster oven?
That's it for this week in water. Support comes from Wright Water Engineers, providing water resource engineering in Colorado and beyond for more than 60 years. Projects, services, and resumes are online at WrightWater.com.
And now we check in with KGNU's comment line, which has been rather quiet lately. No comments last week, only one comment this week. And here it is.
I have just listened to the Friday, February 12th, 2022, installment of Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman's piece. I will not dignify it by calling it a report. It's more of a purportedly left-wing Fox News imitation, her material on Joe Rogan. Though I value much of Amy Goodman's work, I consider this segment an example of dangerously bad journalism. I hold no brief for Mr. Rogan, but Goodman's treatment of him seems to me unfair and myopic. She offers quotations from Rogan, taken completely out of context, and concludes from them that Rogan is a racist. She refers to some of his recent interviewees, presumably Drs. McCullough and Malone, as anti-vaxxers when they don't qualify as such. In doing so, she falls into this kind of dangerous, two-valued, pro-vax, anti-vax thinking that does violence to the important questions at issue. We can all agree, I hope, that some vaccines in some situations prove beneficial, with the polio vaccine as a prime example. That we agree with that, though, doesn't mean that we agree that all vaccines in all situations yield benefit. I have no medical expertise, but I would much prefer that the important questions they raise receive some serious discussion, not simple dismissal. The current partnership between big pharma and government seems to me one that begs further investigation, further questioning, not a lemming-like acceptance of government policy. My real name is Tim Lyons.
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. Individual comments longer than 90 seconds may be edited for brevity. That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to Stacey Johnson, Steve Miller, Sarah Flower, Jamie Sudler, and Franny Halperin for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for the Rising Tide podcast. That's in place of How on Earth, and that's coming up just after these news headlines from the BBC.